and the guest. Thanks for joining us on Vince Day on the Jefferson Exchange. Lots of people enjoy watching birds. Few people watch them with the intensity and follow-through of Julie Zickefoos. You'll know what I mean if you get a few pages into her book, Baby Birds, in which she details the life of birds from hatchling to flying, an amazingly short period, under 2 weeks usually. Julie Zickefoos has a wealth of talents. She's worked for several years as a wildlife biologist, and she both writes and creates art about the birds she observes. Her writing has appeared often in Birdwatcher's Digest, and she's painted more than 24 covers for the magazine. And her voice may sound familiar, too, from the 5 years Julie spent contributing wildlife commentary to All Things Considered on NPR. She lives in a wildlife sanctuary in the Appalachian foothills of Ohio. Julie, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be with you.
Did the role of bird foster mother come from planning or just by circumstance?
I think I've always been unable to walk by a little creature in need, so I'd say it's by circumstance and just, you know, by having a big heart. I started out my life in a suburb of Richmond, Virginia, and the lady next door to us had 17 free-roaming cats.
Oh,
so you can imagine the carnage that I was picking up all the time and trying to fix. And one of my proudest accomplishments was probably done before I was the age of 11 or 12, and that was when I convinced her to keep all her cats inside and furthermore get them spayed.
Wow, that was an amazing, that was quite, you were 12 years old?
Yeah, it was like a little bit of activism. I started collecting pictures of what actually happens to animals at humane shelters and convinced her.
Wow, that's amazing right there. Yeah, you launched your career as a naturalist right then and there.
And an activist, too, I'd say.
Yeah, no doubt. You point out right away in this book, you remind us anyway, that we're told as kids, don't touch birds' nests. And what's the real truth there?
Well, the truth is that you shouldn't be touching birds' nests, but not for the reasons that our parents give us, which is that the mother will smell us on the baby and never take care of it again. That's not actually the mechanism there. What happens if we mess with wild birds' nests and we lead a scent trail to the nest by returning to it repeatedly is we bring it to the attention of predators that follow scent trails, and they happily will clean it out for us and eat the babies or the eggs. So the overall perception is that the parents have abandoned the nest, but it's because we've meddled with it. So what I had to do when I was painting the pictures for this book is make sure that I was working only with nests that were absolutely protected from predators. Those included nests that were in my nest boxes, which are protected by stovepipe baffles on the electrical conduit on which the boxes are mounted, or nests that were otherwise inaccessible, such as in a hanging basket or something like that.
All right, so obviously this process got it's a repetitive thing, but how did it all get started? When did you decide to document the birds this way?
Well, I've always kept nature journals that I've illustrated and then written copious notes, much in the style of Edith Holden, The Country Diary of an Edwardian Lady, is a book you may have seen. And so I've always done that, and it was a natural outgrowth. When I was tending these 26 bird boxes that I have scattered around my property and the area around, to want to share the miracle that I was witnessing, I would walk up to a box, open it, and the baby birds would be just hatching. And so it was a very natural progression to me to take the bird into the studio just for a few minutes, anywhere from 20 to 40 minutes, to feed it, keep it warm, take care of it, and then put it back in the box after I was done drawing it. So it just kind of sprang up out of a passion to know more, to witness this development, which is, as you pointed out, is amazingly fast, and to draw it and to take notes on it and to just sort of record it. So it just came naturally with bluebirds. And then while I was working with bluebirds that same summer, Carolina wrens nested in a hanging basket hanging on my porch, and I realized I could borrow that baby without bothering anything or hurting anything, and I was off. I just, once I had done a couple of species, I only wanted to do more.
You really have to see them every day, as you point out. How fast do they grow?
Carolina wrens can often leave the nest flying pretty well at day 10.
Wow.
So it is a blindingly fast thing in many cases. By comparison, a bluebird, which is in a comparatively safe and protected cavity nest or a nest box, stays in the nest as long as 21 days. So there's quite a difference in their developmental arcs, and that was the other thing that I was very interested in documenting was how differently different species develop.
Although they look pretty uniformly, as you point out, like blobs of protoplasm when they're born.
They do. And what's so cool is to see the different rates at which they become feathered birds.
If they're not, you know, it's interesting. A couple of years ago, a neighbor had a nest above one of the outdoor lights. And if you got up on the ladder and just tweeted a little bit, just to give it a little whistle, their head sprang open. So is that all baby birds like that, where they're either sleeping or gaping for food?
Well, it's very specific. For instance, baby hummingbirds lie in the nest perfectly motionless and absolutely silent until they feel the wind from the mother bird's wings. And until they hear her specific call, they will not open their mouths. And that's because they want to be invisible to predators until they know it's their mother. And even birds like robins or phoebes, which were probably the birds that you were seeing on that light, will react that way, but only while they're fairly young. Once their eyes open and they reach about 6 to 7 days of age, they get suspicious and they no longer will do that.
You point out that the rapid development of songbirds in particular is sort of a healthy thing for them. Why?
Well, because the nest is the most dangerous place any bird has to stay. The fact that the babies are there, helpless, can't really locomote, can't move out of the nest, and they're lying there for as much as 9 days or sometimes 15 or 16 days makes them extremely vulnerable to predators. So the first thing that they try to do is get out of the nest where they can disperse into the shrubbery, and by means of giving constant location calls, their parents can find them and feed them wherever they are. That's a lot safer. It's not putting all your eggs in one basket, so to speak.
I wonder, given how fast they develop, if you can see changes just in the 20 or 40 minutes you spend with them.
I wouldn't say I have seen that, but I will say that the changes over 24 hours are sometimes absolutely stunning. So, yeah, I mean, if you looked really closely, you might be able to see a feather grow a little longer, I would think, yes.
So, from day to day, was it hard to figure out if you had the same guy you picked out yesterday?
Well, interestingly enough, anybody who's ever had a puppy or a kitten knows, born in their home, knows that a kitten will stake out one of the mother's teeth as its own, and it will always take that same position on her belly as they're nursing. Well, the birds, baby birds, seem to keep the same place in the nest. And so I could reach in at 4 o'clock in the nest and pretty much know I had the same bird.
It's an amazing process that Julie Zicafus went through. Her book is called Baby Birds, An Artist Looks Into the Nest. We'll come back and talk more with her later on. Dave Stauffer, running for Oregon governor, back on the Jefferson Exchange with you in a minute 20. On the Jefferson Exchange, on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Julie Zicafus, biologist, artist, writer, sometime radio commentator. She's the author of a book called Baby Birds, An Artist Looks Into the Nest. She actually painted birds, taking them out of the nest day by day, from essentially just hatched to when they fledged, when they flew out of the nest. And it's an amazingly short period of time with some amazingly detailed pictures by Julie with drawing and paints as well. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange if you have something to add, something to ask Julie, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Julie, what was your routine for drawing the nestlings?
Well, if I was working with a box on my property, a nest on my property, I would go out, try to make it the same time every day, take the baby gently out of the nest, carry it into the house. If it was cold, I carried it under my shirt against my belly, cupped in my hand, and then I would take it, put it under a little warm lamp on Kleenexes right on my paper, and I would draw it from life as it squirmed around. And that's a kind of a special skill set. I also fed it age-appropriate food and made sure it was happy and well-fed, and I find they wriggle less if they have something to eat. They're a lot like toddlers.
All right, that was the question, but hey, kept them still. So it's
yeah, sometimes they didn't stay still, and in fact, you'll find in my notes on the both wren species that I worked with, house and Carolina wrens, they were very frustrating to draw when they got to be about a week old because they were just crawling all over the place.
It struck me after a while, you're kind of like the baby photographer in reverse. Instead of saying, look at the birdie, you know.
Yeah, right. Hey, look at this food.
So Carolina wrens are at the top of your list for a number of reasons. Tell us about them and what makes them so fascinating.
Well, when I was a field assistant to a guy working in Amazonian Brazil when I was in college, one of my sort of grim tasks was to prepare specimens from the birds he was mist netting in the forest. And I noticed as I was cleaning these specimens and skinning them and stuffing them that there was one genus of wrens, Triotherus, which had enormous brains relative to their body size. I was already intrigued with Carolina wrens, who are of that same genus. And when I was growing up, I had noticed that they exhibited some very intelligent behaviors. And so I kind of put it together that these giant brains and these intelligent behaviors were not coincidences. So when we moved to this wonderful place in the country in Ohio, we're in southeast Ohio, Appalachian Ohio, and if I would prop the front door open just to bring in groceries, this pair of Carolina wrens would say, "Oh, thank you very much. We'd love to inspect your house." They would come hopping in after me and hop all around the house, taking spiders out of webs in the corners and that kind of thing. They'd go into the bedrooms, into the bathrooms, just poking around, you know. And then I'd say, "Okay, chop, chop, everybody out." And they would just hop right past me and out the same door they'd come into. So it was like, it was a very special thing. And yeah, there was a touch of Disneyland about it, but there's a touch of Disney about everything I do.
They didn't help you get dressed, though, like the bluebirds in the Disney commercial.
And
cartoons.
I'm not dressed like Snow White, nor do I go, I'm an alto.
Those are pretty good rendition.
Thank you.
The eggs and the hatchlings, I noticed, of Carolina wrens are really small. How small?
Oh, wow. I'd say that a Carolina wren egg is about the size of your ring fingernail, and maybe a little larger, depending on your finger. But yeah, super small, and of course, the hatchling that comes out of it, not much bigger. So I found as the project went on and I got older and I needed to get progressive lenses that really I was maxing out what my eyes could see with these newly hatched chickadees and wrens. They were so tiny.
So how carefully did you have to handle them?
Pretty carefully, but as I told my husband when he first picked up our firstborn daughter, honey, you can just pick her up. They're made of rubber.
That is true.
And he looked at me like, oh, okay. And that really helped him. He said that was the most helpful thing anybody ever said to him.
We're talking to Julie Zickafoos about her book, Baby Birds, An Artist Looks Into the Nest. Here's a call from Grumpy John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Jeff, I had always thought that you're not supposed to touch a bird out of its nest because it would keep the parents away or scare the parents away. So if she'd elaborate on that, is that totally wrong, or is her activity a special case, or just what's going on there? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is the first question that everybody has, and so it's a hump that I kind of have to get over when I'm giving a talk or telling someone about the book. Let's start with the legality. I'm a licensed wildlife rehabilitator, both state and federal permits, so I know what to feed these things, and I know how to handle them. I also only worked with nests that were absolutely protected from predators, such as in a suspended hanging basket or in one of my nest boxes, which is protected by a 2-foot-long length of stovepipe, which keeps any predator from climbing up to it. But I think Grumpy John is also getting at another issue, which is that we're told from the time we're very small that if we touch a baby bird, the mother will desert it because she'll smell it, smell our scent on the baby. Well, songbirds can't smell, at least not well, and they also will not desert a baby because someone has touched it. They are much more bonded to their young than that. So I had a unique skill set. I had the permits that I needed. I have the ability to draw rapidly from life, and I was operating by the physician's creed, which is first, do no harm. And so that was my guiding light there. And in several cases, the baby survived because I was there to intervene. One when a baby was strangling on some nest material and I saved it. Another when one got an air sac problem and I saved that one. And then several times when the nest would have been raided by predators had I not protected the nest with baffles. So all in all, I actually helped the young birds survive in doing so and did not harm any in the making of the book.
Yeah, some of the emergency room procedures you had to perform on the birds is pretty, and it's amazing, particularly the one when you talked about the choking one. The bird sounds like they'll chomp down on anything at that age.
Yeah, actually, they have a swallowing reflex, so that if anything touches the back of their gape, they just kind of automatically swallow it. If that turns out to be a long piece of grass from the nest, they're in trouble. So, I had a couple of instances where babies were swallowing nest material, and one where a baby swallowed, I think, an inch and a quarter long, hard wooden ash petiole that was every bit as hard as a toothpick. And it was just lodged in this poor thing's digestive tract, and I managed to work it up out, and that baby made it. So there were lots of times when I felt like it was meant to be that I was observing these babies so closely. And I'd also stress that they were wild. They were being raised by their parents, and I in no way did I impact that.
Well, you know, you not only monitor the behavior of the birds, you monitor your own behavior, and you did learn some lessons along the way, as you point out. Tell us about what happened when you tried to grab a nestling in darkness.
Well, grab isn't quite the word I use, but I had a situation where I was doing a show opening of my art, and I couldn't get to the nest in daylight. So I this was a nest in a hanging basket on my front porch of Carolina wrens. I knew the birds very well. The parents were totally acclimated to me, as I've described. And so I came back at about 10:30 at night, and I thought, I got to do today's painting. So I thought, I'll borrow a baby while they're sleeping, and this will be slick. I can just do this. Well, I reached toward the nest just by the porch light, and I heard a sound that was exactly like the sound of a striking snake. I know that because I've been bitten several times, and once most famously by a copperhead.
Wow.
They make this weird little popping sound when they're striking at you. It's like, it's the weirdest little sound. I jerked my hand back as if I'd been burned because it was such an instinctive reaction. And I found that these Carolina wrens were making that sound and striking just like snakes. It was one of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen.
Wow, they are smart, aren't they?
Yeah, well, that's probably instinctive. And when you think about these encoded behaviors that help them survive and how many of them are instinctive, you know, a baby Carolina wren has no experience of snakes. It couldn't have a possibly know what that sound is, and yet it can produce the sound.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Julie Zicafus is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, artist, writer, biologist. She's the author of Baby Birds, An Artist Looks Into the Nest. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. So after the Carolina wrens, you move us on to the eastern bluebird. You've gone to some great lengths to help members of this species. Tell us about some of those exploits.
Well, you know, I get a lot of calls as a wildlife rehabilitator, sometimes 5 and 6 calls a day in the summer. And these are all birds that people have found or they're orphaned or something, and they want me to take care of them. It's extremely time-consuming. But in this case, I was extremely glad to get these 3 orphaned female bluebirds to raise because they allowed me to track their plumage development through day 65. Otherwise, I would have had to stop painting the birds at about 12 days of age because you can only peek into a bird's nest for so long before the young birds get they reach a point which I call the age of sentience, where they suddenly have a mental image of bird and not bird.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as if they wake up and they go, oh, you're not a bird. I'm afraid. And then they will jump out of the nest if you mess with it. So you have to be extremely careful after that age of day 12 or 13. So I had finished my bluebird series, and I really wanted to paint them longer. And just by providence, I got this wonderful batch of 3 baby female bluebirds that I could raise and paint to my heart's content.
I laugh at the description of the emergency food you made for some of the bluebird nestlings.
Oh, you don't want to have a bug omelet?
Yeah.
They're so delicious. Yeah, it's pretty disgusting. But it's a very, very good emergency food for birds. I scramble an egg, and I grind up and crush the eggshell, and I work that back into the omelet so they're getting all that calcium. And then I add to that dried flies. And it smells absolutely nauseating when you're cooking it, but it is a wonderful rocket sauce for baby birds.
Do you keep 2 sets of dishes, one for cooking things for birds and one for cooking things for humans?
Much to my husband's chagrin, I do not.
There's an interesting side story here, too, about orphaned bluebirds and a rehab project with them and the amount of work you have to go through. I mean, how often do you have to feed them, for example?
Well, about every half hour when they're young. And as they get older, you can stretch it to 1 to 2 hours. But the bottom line is you have to be there. And you have to be there every day and every hour of every day for these birds. So, for instance, if you're the only one feeding them and there's no one you can fob it off onto, you have to take them with you if you go somewhere for several hours.
Really? Like where?
Well, the bank, town. I live 18 miles from town. My minimum time that I would spend in town would be an hour and a half. That would be if I ran in and ran back out, right?
Mm-hmm.
So basically, I'd put them in a pet carrier and bring them with me, bring their food and feed them the whole time I was in town. If I had an appointment that stretched an hour or so, I'd have to bring them.
So it sounds like you actually had to teach them to eat?
No, they do that instinctively, but I have had some charges who were compromised for whatever reason, and so you do have to force feed them at first.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah. But what about getting them to find their own stuff?
Oh, you're talking about picking up their own food.
Yeah.
Well, they have the instinctive equipment, like the brain connections, to do that on their own, but they have to be stimulated by living food, so you have to feed them live, like mealworms and crickets. And the other thing is that my bluebirds didn't start getting interested in picking up their own food until about day 30. And they weren't any good at it until about day 35. And they weren't reliably feeding themselves until they were 47 days old.
Hmm.
So you have to make sure that you're subsidizing them. You can't just assume that because they're old enough they're going to be picking up enough food. Have to keep feeling their breastbone to make sure that they have a good layer of fat, that they aren't getting thin on you. You have to assess their condition all the time. And at the point at which you no longer have to subsidize them at all, they're picking everything else, everything up from the dish, then you're ready to move their flying tent out into the yard and open the flaps and release them.
Which leads perfectly into the next question, which is how do you, as a non-flying individual, teach birds how to fly?
Birds don't need to be taught how to fly. They fly as naturally as babies walk.
Hmm.
So, it's a rote set of movements, and they figure it out very quickly. But they do definitely need to be taught how to rely on their own food gathering skills. So you have to be, you know, firm but gentle, and make sure that you always have food available for them. I call it soft release. You just basically subsidize them until they no longer need the subsidy, and that can be a month and a half after they are flying.
Hmm. So for some of these birds, like eastern bluebirds, I mean, when are they considered fully grown?
Well, I would say that by about day 60, they are completely without, you know, need of subsidy, and they can function. But that's a lot longer than most people would imagine.
Yeah. We're talking to Julie Zikafoos about her book, Baby Birds, An Artist Looks Into the Nest. She actually monitored baby birds pretty much from hatching out of the egg until they flew. And in some cases, that was 10 days, as she's pointed out. A couple of emails here. Boyd in Wolf Creek, you know, when you mentioned that you have all the licenses, I was going to emphasize this, and he asks the same thing. Please emphasize in several different ways the general public should not help in quotes, baby birds. More harm than benefit will be the outcome when humans intervene, and it's illegal.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of what I call friendly abduction in the general public, where people see a baby bird sitting on the ground and it looks so helpless and it's ever so cute with its short little tail. And their first instinct is to pick it up and put it in a box and try and feed it white bread or worms. And, you know, basically what people need to realize is that most of these songbirds fledge from the nest before they're flying very well. And bouncing around on the ground or in low shrubbery is pretty much a normal part of their developmental arc. So the first thing to do is to be absolutely sure that the parents have been killed or the bird is not being tended by its own parents, because the last thing you want to do is abduct a baby that's actually being cared for.
Right. Okay. Then we have a question from Ariel via email. She writes, a couple of weeks ago, while walking near a creek, I found an empty eggshell about the size of a chicken egg. It was totally intact except for a large jagged hole in the side. The hole didn't look like anything a human could do. What caused it? Hatching? Predator? How did it get there?
Well, a hatched egg will always have a very neatly perforated, almost like a pinked edge, halfway through it. So it's you can tell when a baby bird is hatched from an egg. If you find an egg that has a jagged hole and you can actually usually see some egg white inside, that's definitely been done by a predator. And my most likely guess in that case would be a crow grabbing the egg and piercing it with its bill and eating the contents.
Does that sound like a duck egg, that size of egg?
Yeah, duck, turkey, grouse, hard to say since I don't really know where this person was. But, yeah, if it's about the size of a chicken egg, I'd say so.
I'm still curious about the art part of this, about taking the baby birds out of their nests. Did you just draw them, or did you draw and paint it at one sitting?
I drew and painted. What I would do is do two or three quick sketched studies, and then when I had the sketches, the pencil sketches all done, I would usually paint one. And if time was wasting and I felt like I needed to get the baby back to the nest quickly for whatever reason, I would usually paint one so I had all the colors. And then after I'd return the baby to the nest, I would go ahead and paint the other two using the first as my guide.
Who were the trickiest birds to document for this book?
I would say that the chimney swifts were probably the toughest for me. As a rehabilitator, they are not the bunny slope of bird rehab. They are very hard to feed. They are very subject to dehydration. They need a lot of moisture with their food. And I had a learning curve where I lost a couple before I got in touch with the right people who could tell me what I needed to do to keep them alive. And I'll stress that I did not kidnap these. These were orphans that were brushed out of a chimney by an unscrupulous chimney sweep.
So really, unscrupulous or just unaware?
I have to say that anybody who cleans chimneys for a living knows darn well what those weird rasping sounds are, that they're coming from baby chimney swifts and that they are a protected migratory bird. You don't kill chimney swifts, nor do you remove their nests legally. So I have nothing but scorn for a chimney sweep who would respond to a call saying, I have weird noises coming out of my chimney, and then just run a big brush down the chimney and just dislodge the nest and knock it down.
Okay. Certainly issues with human behavior. Can you still be surprised by bird behavior, Julie?
Oh, absolutely. All the time.
It's a wonderful book and a really amazing look at what is just an astonishing growth rate for baby birds. The book is called Baby Birds, subtitled An Artist Looks Into the Nest. Julie Zikavus did all the research for it, did all the drawings, did all the writing, did all the painting. Julie, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you very much. Right. I really liked it.
Okay, good pleasure here, too.